This is Rabbi Jason Holtz of Bromley Reform Synagogue recording the second session of Introduction to Reform Judaism on the 14th of May, 2017. So we're going to back up a little bit, talk a little bit, just to summarize a little bit of where we left off last week, and then we're going to cover new ground and new material. Okay? So last week, I have my marker. Last week we were talking about the 19th century. So what was going on in the 19th century? I know that's 100 years, but in terms of relevance to the Jewish people in Europe. Revolution, so French Revolution, for example. A little bit earlier, the American Revolution, which wasn't Europe, but still kind of affected modern Western world a little bit. So revolution, and with revolution, Jews become emancipated. Following the French Revolution, following the American Revolution, and so on, you started country by country finding Jews gaining equal rights and Jews becoming citizens. I did a little bit of research, and the transition from British subject to British citizen was a bit later, but you did have this new concept, or at least a concept brought back to Europe, that one can be a citizen of a country and that one has certain rights based on one's citizenship that cannot be taken away from you. And one of those was freedom of religion. And any citizen of a country, so long as they took to these new modern ideals, they would have the freedom of religion and freedom of assembly and all these other things that make religious life possible for somebody in the minority position. So that's one thing. Good. So revolution, and with it, emancipation. Revolution and emancipation, we'll just put it that way. Okay? Which gave the Jewish people lots of different options that they didn't have before. Before, they weren't really given any options. If you were Jewish, you lived in the ghetto. Or if you were Jewish, you lived in the shtetl. And you had a pretty closed Jewish community there, not necessarily by choice, but rather because that's how things played out. Now all of a sudden, you can be Jewish and live in Berlin. You can be Jewish and go to university in Berlin. You could be Jewish and rise up the ranks in a lot of different European societies. Or you could completely give up your Jewish identity, and that's possible too. That was pretty hard back in the day too. If you're always forced to live in the ghetto, always forced to live in the shtetl, you didn't really have a lot of options. So we talked about being both Jewish and modern. And with that, you had a few different alternatives. You could be just one or just the other. So I'll say Jewish or modern, or Jewish and modern. For the different people that said both, you had a few different possibilities. One was Reform Judaism, which meant that you could be Jewish, but you could also be modern at the same time. So you could go to university, you could get a degree, you could work with, you could be an accountant or an attorney or whatever it was, a shop owner, it doesn't really matter. You could sell to whomever, you could buy from whomever, you could do business with whomever, you could do all that. You could go to public schooling or state schooling or whatever else. You didn't have to go to a school run by the Jewish community, for the Jewish community, where your subject matter was pretty much set only to Jewish subject matters with a little bit of reading and writing and arithmetic on the side. But you could also have a broader education at Oxford University if you're talented enough to get there. And that opened up a lot of doors. But at the same time, you could also belong to a Jewish synagogue. You could be part of the Jewish community, and the Jewish community could adapt itself so that it was no longer limited to people living in the ghetto or in the shtetl, but it could be adapted so that you could have a synagogue serve people who worked in the wider world and who interacted in the wider world. And Judaism itself would keep some core elements, belief in one God, the importance of ethics, and so on and so on, but the rest of it, everything else was up for discussion and debate. Why was not what allowed?
to live outside.
Why was it not permitted outside? Well, the first place to do it was Venice, but it was a long time coming, and a lot of it had to do with the Roman Catholic Church and others who had a theology based on Jewish humiliation, that because Jews did not accept Jesus, they had to be seen as, they could not be seen as thriving, whatever else. They had to be seen as whatever, and particularly in Italy, it wasn't really Italy at the time, but particularly in that area where the Catholic Church was strongest, Venice was one of them, it was deemed that mixing between Jews and Christians was probably not the best thing. And there were all sorts of rules and regulations, and even before the Venetian ghetto, there was a lot of distrust and a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment and so on. Jews in this country were exiled hundreds of years ago. Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice about a Jewish merchant at a time when no Jews were living in England. He was writing because they'd already been exiled and they had not yet been readmitted into this country. So when Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice, he did so based completely on the myth of the greedy Jew who's always out for his pound of flesh. Never met a Jewish person in his life. But there was that sort of assumption about Jews by the greater European population that wasn't so well. I could give 10 hours to the discussion of the treatment of Jews in Europe before modernity. And there were times that it actually was okay. But generally speaking, Jews were seen as, and eventually came to see themselves as, a people apart. They were seen as some, they weren't seen as French or English or German or wherever they happened to live. They were always seen as Jews who just happened to be living in this place or that place, and it was more or less seen as the mixing wasn't a great idea. It's completely different between Jews in Muslim lands. Spain when it was Muslim, the Ottoman Empire and so on. It's a completely different story there, but there was a bit more animosity in Europe with Christians and Jews, which is sad, and it's unfortunate, and it's not the case today for the most part, although there are occasionally remnants of it. There's a passion play in Oberammergau, and that particular passion play around the time of Easter always came out with the moral of the story as Jews killed Jesus, so go get them. And there were always pogroms and riots and anti-Jewish sentiments after that. And every rabbi in this country recently received an advert to go see the Oberammergau play, which is still being performed.
So they realized that Jesus was Jewish.
Yes. That's the Second Vatican Council and all this other... So that's the Roman Catholic Church. Church of England's in... I mean, the Church of England's very friendly. We've got great relations with our neighbors right here with the Anglican Church. But there was a process to get there. And that process is just beginning in the 19th century. And for the most part, the progress doesn't start with the churches. The progress starts in the secular realm. And you don't get great interfaith, multi-faith dialogue until a little bit later. The emancipation, the equal rights, and so on, starts from secular authorities. And that's part of modernity, is that you actually have secular authorities independent from the church. You might have always had a mayor who was not necessarily a church official, but the mayor would not have necessarily crossed the church. Now all of a sudden you have an independence between the two. So that plays into modernity and the rise of reform. This is the transition period from a medieval time. For Jews, medieval ages went a little bit longer than for the rest of Europe, but that transition from kind of a medieval period where if you're not part of the majority, then you're underclass somehow. And there was a transition period. And for Europe, a lot of that transition period happened in the 19th century. And in the mid-20th century, with World War II, everything blew up. But there was a period before World War II where you could see progress being made. Okay, so reform. Against reform, you had something called neo-orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is as much a product of the 19th century as reform is. In fact, reform predates orthodoxy just by a little bit, because orthodoxy is a reaction against reform. There's no such thing as orthodoxy. There's no such thing as reform before the 19th century. Orthodoxy, what orthodoxy did, neo-orthodoxy, there were a few different types of orthodoxy. Neo-orthodoxy or modern orthodox what we think of now as the United Synagogue, Catford Synagogue up the road, this would more or less be the camp that they would fall into of Neo-Orthodoxy. But what Neo-Orthodoxy said was you can be modern and Jewish, but Judaism doesn't have to change for you to be modern. Reform Jews said, of course, Judaism will adapt to the modern world. So we have things like equality between the genders now. And that's part of us adapting to the modern world. Neo-Orthodoxy would say you can be part of the modern world, but Judaism doesn't have to change because of it. So we're going to basically take the Judaism that they inherited, so say 17th century Judaism, or 18th century Judaism, because we're now in the 19th century, so they look at what their parents did, they look at what their grandparents did, they said, ritually speaking, we can keep all of that and still be part of the modern world. Which is why at Catford Synagogue, men and women still sit separate, and you'll never see a woman leading services, and so on and so on. The change, there's a conscious decision not to change the ritual side of Judaism. So that's Neo-Orthodoxy. You also have Zionism. And there was a little bit of cross-pollination between Reform and Zionist or Neo-Orthodox and Zionist, meaning some people saw it possible to be this and that, but for the most part at this period of time, 19th century, you picked one. And Zionism mostly was a secular movement, whereas these two were religious movements. And Zionism was all about building up what eventually became the modern state of Israel and so on and so on, embracing values like democracy and state building and whatnot. So it's definitely a modern movement, but it's also a Jewish movement because it's about creating a, well, there's a debate over were they creating a Jewish state or were they creating a state for the Jews, which wasn't necessarily a Jewish state but more of a secular state. And that debate still goes on in Israel today. Okay? And then eventually you found some Orthodox people saying, yeah, you can be this and this, or Reform people saying you can be this and this. But early on, it was mostly separate camps. Okay. You also had some people who wanted just one or the other. So ultra-Orthodox would be only Jewish. People who wanted to assimilate and convert, Benjamin Disraeli's family, they would choose just modern and kind of give up all affiliation with it. But we're going to focus on only one of those possibilities, which is Reform Judaism, because that's why we're here. Okay, so some things I just introduced it a little bit, but the university in particular, the modern university, had a huge effect on Reform Jewish thought early on. And some of the subject matters that were interesting. One was the academic study of history, meaning you could show that everything that happens in human history, and this was one of the tenets of this academic study of history, everything that happens is a product of historical circumstances. Nothing happens outside of history. Everything happens within history. And the best way to understand something is to understand its historical context. If you want to understand a religious idea, for example, theology does not exist absent the study of history and why people believe what they believe. What historical event took place? Or what was the cultural setting that made somebody say, the reason why this happened is because this was the world in which it happened. So there's no such thing as a pure idea independent of its historical context. So that was one thing. Reform Judaism took that and said, every ritual that developed in Judaism, let's say keeping kosher, for example. Let's say, I don't know, the calendar of festivals. All of that happened because of a certain historical context. The three major festivals in the Jewish tradition, Sukkot, Passover, and Shavuot, were all agricultural festivals. Is that because there's this eternal notion that we always have to celebrate the harvest, or is it because in ancient Israel, 90% of the people were farmers, and it was particularly relevant to their lives, celebrating the harvest? And the historian would say, yes, it's always good to be grateful for what we have, harvest festivals, but you also have to understand the reason why we had these three major harvest festivals is because everybody was a farmer, living in an agrarian rural setting, and so on and so on. And so some of these practices come out of that particular setting. What else? There was Julius Wellhausen, who I mentioned briefly last time. Julius Wellhausen was the son of a Protestant minister, and he came up with something called the documentary hypothesis, which was taught in universities for a while. It's still taught a little bit in universities, but the theory has been updated somewhat. But what Wellhausen said was there were four different authors of the five books of Moses. So Genesis through Deuteronomy were written by four different authors. That's what Wellhausen posited. And then he went on to argue why he thought it was the case. And long story short, a lot of people found it pretty convincing, people in the university-type setting. And what that led to was a rethinking of the notion that the entire five books of Moses were divinely authored. If you can find four different voices in the Torah, four distinct voices with distinct vocabulary, with distinct references to historical events, with distinct preferences for a certain kind of ritual life over another kind of ritual life, then all of a sudden you get rid of one author, and if there's not one author, then at least some of it had to be written by a human being, not by God. That completely revolutionized Jewish thought. Religious thought generally, it made its way into the Christian world too. Like I said, Wellhausen, who came up with this idea, was the son of a Protestant minister. But it was an example of Jews being influenced by the secular university. Okay. What else? There was a German philosopher named Hegel, George Hegel. And Hegel was a philosopher. And his big idea was that every period in human history is probably better than the one that preceded it. It was a philosophy of progress and a philosophy of history. That history is moving in a direction towards everything that's modern is good or better than what came before it. And it really was exactly what he said. It was a very extreme argument for progress. And a lot of people who found themselves in the Reform camp were reading either Hegel or Hegelian-type philosophies that said progress is good, modernity is good, things that came before the medieval ages were bad. That's part of where you get the term Dark Ages from. It also goes back to the Renaissance, but after the destruction of Rome, anything before modernity, or at least before the Renaissance, were the Dark Ages. And you can see the judgment of historians based on this time period. Or anytime you hear somebody refer to an older period of time as being a worse period of time than modernity, that's a Hegelian type idea. So all of a sudden, that gives people living in the 19th century a bit of authority to bring modern ideas, modern progress, whatever you want to call it, to religious life. It could be the music. It didn't just have to do with politics and social rights, by the way. It had to do with everything. Music was better in the 19th century than it was in the medieval ages. People were better at making instruments. You had a longer period of time for the musical traditions to develop. They become more complicated in a better sort of way. So why not update the aesthetics? Why not use a trumpet instead of a shofar? So a shofar is the ram's horn, or at least some sort of animal's horn that we blow on the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. Why not use a trumpet? It sounds nicer. It's the modern equivalent. And modern's better. Why do we still write in scrolls? That's a pain. It takes a year to write the Torah scroll. Why not use a book? And on and on and on. You can get the idea. Hegel's philosophy went out the window with the 20th century, with all the World War I, World War II, the Holocaust. The 20th century was abysmal. It's only in the 19th century that you can look backwards and say progress is great. After you get to the 20th century, nobody's in the university-type setting is really making that argument anymore. It could go either way. You could move forward in time and things could get worse. You could move forward in time and things could get better. Some people do still make the argument, I guess, that in general, they'll say those are exceptions, not the rule. Those are exceptions to the rule. Martin Luther King said that in the 1960s. He said that the arc of history is long, but it's bent towards justice. He said that in the 1960s, you know, maybe a generation after World War II. I don't know. And in the particular historical context as well. He was trying to make it seem like history was on his side. And Hegel was always saying that modernity, history is on their side. So that was an influence on Reform Judaism. Okay. So, if history brings new, or if modernity brings new options, if things change over time, If, let's get rid of 19th century. Let's say, from the point of view of a 19th century Jew who has studied history in a university, if, as a product of their studies, they've learned that 18th century German Jewish practice is different than the practice in the Middle East, Jewish communities, their contemporaries, or it's different than the practice of 1,000 years ago still in Germany, or that in biblical times Jewish practice was different. What that means to the Jew living in the 19th century is that certain things have changed over time. Men and women sitting separately, that was the product of the medieval ages. Archaeologists can show, and textual historians can show, that 2,000 years ago men and women did not sit separately. But they can show all these changes over time. Keeping kosher. The rule, the idea of keeping kosher stayed the same, but the specifics of it had changed from place to place. If that's the case, then all of a sudden you can say there's a lot of Judaism that doesn't come from God, that just comes from cultural practice. So let's change it. Let's identify those areas that are part of cultural practice, that are invented by people, and let us be the judge of whether or not we want to keep it or whether or not we want to change it. So some of the first things to get changed by Reformed Jews were the aesthetics of a worship service. So going into the 19th century, in most Jewish synagogues, the practice was you get a bunch of people together for a prayer service, and then everybody does more or less everything on their own. There'd be a little bit that they do together, but everybody's got their prayer book and everybody's going at a different pace and everyone's mumbling quietly under their breath because it's about their individual prayer to God set in the context of a community, but it's not the community as a whole that's doing it. There's a few exceptions, but 80% of the service would be like that. All of a sudden you get these 19th century German Jews and say, you know what, we really don't like that aesthetic. We want something a little bit more refined. We'll say everything together, we'll get a nice choir, maybe we'll bring in an organ, we'll do everything together, we'll call out page numbers. That was one of the first reforms, calling out page numbers. So rather than everybody going at their own pace, somebody would stand up front and say page 202, page 232, and then let's read together. It wasn't, to me it doesn't sound all that revolutionary. At the time it was. At the time it completely changed everything. Giving a sermon. We know that sermons were a big deal about 2,000 to 1,000 years ago, but somewhere around 1,000 years ago, the practice of giving a sermon had died off in Jewish contexts, except for twice a year, around the High Holy Days and around Passover. 19th century Jews had brought it back. They said that actually, we don't have a chance for live religious instruction and studying Torah and learning about Torah from a rabbi or from whoever is preaching on the given day is more important to us than setting aside the time for worship. So they reintroduced the sermon on a weekly basis.
Has that also changed to Orthodoxy?
Yeah, that's made its way to Orthodoxy, depending upon the synagogue, but yes. Orthodoxy is not as stagnant as some Orthodox Jews or others would have you believe. The old joke was that Reformed Jews would make the change first, and they would argue based on sociological and historical reasons, and then Masorti or conservative Jews would make the change about 40 years later, say, we found a textual source that allows us to do this, and then 40 years after that, the Orthodox Jews would make the same change and say, we've been doing it this way all along. But that was some of the things. All those changes were made through the early changes, were not made actually in Reformed Judaism based on sociological, historical arguments. They knew that they could, but they didn't want to just do that. They also brought in Jewish legal material. So the Talmud, ancient rabbinic writings, is very famous for having always preserved the minority opinion because according to the Talmud, the future generation might wish to go by the minority opinion rather than the majority. So they always write down the minority opinion. So a lot of the early Reformed Jews just went back and found the minority opinions and published them and said, we're going to do it this way.
Was that the same period of time when part of the service was read in English, as you know?
I'm sorry?
And when part of the service was read in English.
Yeah, so that was another big thing, the vernacular. Can some of the service be done in the vernacular? Now, early on, that was also the case for Reformed Jews, that some of the service should be done in the spoken language. They would make the argument that at the time that the Hebrew service was done, a lot more Jews were fluent or knowledgeable in the Hebrew language. But they would also say, you know what, not all the prayer book anyways, the traditional prayer book is in Hebrew. Some of it's in Aramaic. The mourner's Kaddish, Yit Gadal, Ve'yit Kaddash, Shemei Rabbah, that's not Hebrew. That's Aramaic, because the spoken language of Jews at the time that it was written down was not Hebrew, it was Aramaic. So they said, why can't we have prayers in German? Or why can't we have prayers in English? Or prayers in French? Or whatever it is. By the way, there is a translation of the Kaddish, which we still do in Aramaic here. If you go to the State of Israel, and you look at a Reformed prayer book there, you'll find it translated into Hebrew. Because it's not Hebrew. And it's still a debate in a lot of progressive, reform, liberal, and so on synagogues over whether or not it's appropriate to do this part in English, that part in Hebrew, how much English, and so on, back and forth, back and forth.
Well, surely the layman, as I am,
understands
it better.
Yeah, that's certainly. Better, you know. Even I, as a rabbi, understand English better. I can do Hebrew, but my first language is English. It's an easier language for me. I'm an American, I didn't grow up in Israel, so you can learn a second language. It's possible for anyone, but it'll never be the same as your first language.
Where did the word Hebrew come from?
The Hebrew word la'avor, or ivri, and la'avor means to cross over, because Abraham, the first Jew, crossed over the Jordan River to come into Israel, so he became an ivri, somebody who crossed over.
Right.
Okay, I want to read for you some historical documents from the 19th century by various reform organizations to show, in their own words, what exactly they were doing, what they were thinking, and so on. So I am going to start with something from West London Synagogue, which was the first reform synagogue in this country. I think it's 177 years old, 176 years old. And they started, they were a breakaway from Bevis Marks Synagogue here. So as much as I say Reformed Judaism started in Germany in 1810, and therefore it kind of has Ashkenazi or German roots, in this country that's not the case. In this country, because it's split off from a Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, not a German synagogue, Reformed Judaism in this country has a lot of influences from the Spanish-Portuguese Sephardic tradition, in addition to the Ashkenazi tradition as well, but it is one of the things that's pretty unique in this country, the influence of that. So, for example, when I first moved here, we lift the Torah scroll before the Torah reading, whereas Ashkenazi tradition or German tradition is to lift the Torah scroll after the reading. And everybody asked me when I first moved here from America, how hard is it to drive on the left-hand side of the road for you? I said, driving on the left-hand side of the road is easy for me. The cars are set up that way. It's lifting the Torah scroll before the Torah reading that I couldn't wrap my mind around. And I think for about 2 months, I was always about to do it backwards. So let me see here. Okay, I think this is it. Page 210. Okay, got it. Okay, so this is David Wolf Marx speaking in 1842. The title of his speech is The Need for Reform, and it was delivered at West London Synagogue locally, which was the first Reformed congregation in Britain. And David Wolf Marx was their first minister. So he's speaking in 1842, the first minister speaking on the need for reform. He says, I'm only going to read part of this. We must not confound the form with the substance, meaning there's a substance to Judaism, belief in one God and so on, but the form is different than the substance. So the way in which people worship is their English in the service, for example. That's form. It's different from substance. We must not confound the form with the substance. We must not regard an infinity of ceremonials as the final aim of religion, meaning the point of Judaism is not to keep kosher. The point of Judaism is not to speak a Hebrew service. There's an idea beyond that. There's a belief in God. There's a commitment to morality that is beyond and behind all the rituals, and that's what's really important. Viewing as secondary all that is moral, all that is spiritual, all that embraces the eternal salvation of man. Now, since in the progress of time, it has been the misfortune of our people to fall into this particular error, we who purpose to rectify the evil declare at the very outset of our career that it is not a desire for innovation, not a want of respect for those institutions which are our more immediate ancestors obeyed, but a paramount obligation, a deep sense of right that impels us to those measures which, in our inmost hearts, we consider the only means of arousing our brethren from that indifference to spiritual matters into which they have unhappily sunk. So what he's saying is that somewhere along the way, leading up to the 19th century, Jews became a little too preoccupied with ritual and maintaining a ritual in a particular way. For him, the goal of reform at West London Synagogue was to reorient the priorities. It's about belief in God. It's about spirituality. It's about morality. It's not about ritual life. He goes on to say, we must solemnly deny that a belief in the divinity of the traditions contained in the Mishnah, that's rabbinic writing, and the Jerusalem and Babylonian Talmuds, more rabbinic writings, is of equal obligation to the Israelite with the faith in the divinity of the law of Moses. This is before Wellhausen's documentary hypothesis became popular. We know that these books are human compositions, and though we are content to accept with reverence from our post-biblical ancestors advice and instruction, we cannot unconditionally accept their laws. Meaning, fine, they might be laws, but we're legislators too, at the very least. If they legislate for their time, we'll legislate for our time. And so a place like West London Synagogue can start to make its own judgments on what's appropriate from a ritual point of view and whatnot. Other reform places around the world went even farther than West London. So let me read you some documents, one particular document from the United States. It comes from 1885. Here we are. So in 1885 in the United States, a small group of rabbis, I think there were only 15 rabbis, but it sounds more impressive than it was, got together, formed the Central Conference of American Rabbis, and wrote the Pittsburgh Platform, which in the United States was the founding document of Reformed Judaism, one of the founding documents. So it says, first, we recognize in every religion, so you get this universalist tone right away. We recognize in every religion an attempt to grasp the infinite, and in every mode, source, or book of revelation held sacred in any religious system, the consciousness of the indwelling of God in man. We hold that Judaism presents the highest conception of the God idea. God's been reduced to an idea now. Of the God idea as taught in our holy scriptures and developed and spiritualized by the Jewish teachers in accordance with the moral and philosophical progress of their respective ages. We maintain that Judaism preserved and defended amidst continual struggles and trials and under enforced isolation this God idea as the central religious truth for the human race. So God is most important. So they're reorienting what's important, and God comes first. It goes on, I'm going to skip a little bit. We hold that the modern discoveries of scientific researches into the domains of nature and history are not antagonistic to the doctrines of Judaism. You can study history and Judaism at the same time. The Bible reflecting the primitive ideas of its own age. That goes pretty far, right? It calls the Bible primitive. The primitive ideas of its own age and at times clothing its conception of divine providence and justice dealing with man in miraculous narratives. So do away with the miracles. It's just a primitive understanding of God. Third, we recognize in Mosaic legislation, that means the law of Moses, Mosaic legislation, a system of training for the Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine, and today we accept as binding only the moral laws and maintaining only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, and reject all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. I'm not going to go on too much more from there. But it's basically saying that, one, the Bible came from a completely different time, a time called primitive. We don't usually use the word primitive anymore, but in the 19th century it was fine. And because it came out of a historical context that was, in the 19th century mind, primitive, a lot of the laws were presented in a primitive sort of way. Not that the base idea was primitive, it's that the presentation of the ideas was primitive, and that the form in which it was delivered was pretty primitive. And it goes on to say that a lot of those practices actually were particular to national life in Palestine, which is what it was called at that time, in the 19th century. And because Jews no longer had a national life in Palestine, you can more or less do away with most of the laws anyways. Only the moral and spiritual. Okay, where are we? So I'm not going to keep reading from all these different sources, but if I were to pick up some more of these books, Abraham Geiger in Germany, for example, they go so far as to say that keeping kosher is just a form of kitchen Judaism. And he said that somewhat, he said that as a way to dismiss a Judaism focused on keeping kosher, a Judaism focused on this law or that law or another. And what he spoke about was prophetic Judaism. And for him, what prophetic Judaism was a Judaism focused on the ethical, and a Judaism focused on the moral, and a Judaism focused on the spiritual. For a lot of those early Reform Jews in the 19th century, Judaism was trying to reorient themselves. And they took a lot of quotes from the prophets, which actually criticized the ancient biblical Israelites for focusing too much on temple life and sacrifice and rituals and fasts. And prophets who said, in God's name, I don't care about your fasts, I don't care about your sacrifices, you need to take care of the poor, you need to take care of the widow, you need to take care of the stranger and the orphan and so on. That's what God really cares about. God cares way more about that than about fasts and everything else. And none of that's meaningful if you don't focus on social justice issues. So a lot of 19th century Reform Jews completely focused on that. They called Reform Judaism prophetic Judaism based off the prioritization of the prophets, and they moved in that general way, which is why to this day, it's a little bit different in the 21st century than the 19th century, but even in the 21st century, you will not see a lot of Reformed Jews overly preoccupied with ritual. You'll find some, but for most Reformed Jews, their religious life is not centered, or their Jewish life, while ritual is part of it, it's not the overwhelming, dominant feature of their Jewish life. Questions so far? Yeah?
I've got a few, but first, how is Reformed Judaism accepted in Israel?
How is Reformed Judaism accepted in Israel? That's a great question that I'm probably going to talk about next week, because next week I want to talk about Reformed Judaism post-World War II. I want to talk about World War II and the founding of the State of Israel and everything having to do with Reformed Judaism since that time, because just as the 19th century reorganized the Jewish world, World War II and the founding of Save Israel reorganized Jewish life. Some argue we're going through another reorganization now, but that's hard to know until we've moved past this time period and we can only look backwards. But great question. How's Reformed Judaism looked in Israel? The short answer, about 5 to 10% of Israelis identify with Reformed Judaism. That doesn't mean they attend a Reformed synagogue. They just like it in a survey. But legally speaking, it has a lot less of a status than Orthodoxy.
Yeah. People doing different things, but I know quite a few Israelis, and they don't. I feel like I know more sometimes than they do. They, you know.
Yeah, it goes back. So
relation with it, they see themselves as Jewish or Israeli, but don't really fall into.
Yeah, for a lot of secular Israelis, it goes back to that 19th century division that I was talking about. That a lot in the 19th century saw themselves either as Reform or as Orthodox, or as Zionist, and for a lot of secular Israelis, that's still the case. Their Jewish identity is being Israeli. Mm. Their Jewish identity is speaking Hebrew, living in Israel, potentially even serving in the Israeli army, speak to whatever Israeli, and for them, that's what it means to be Jewish. It's much more of a national identity for secular Israelis than it is a religious identity, because early on in the 19th century, Zionism was not for most Zionists, was not a religious category. Being Jewish could also be a national category. Of course, there are some Reformed Jewish Israelis and some Orthodox Israelis and all sorts. But, yeah. Okay. there was question within the Reform world of how far to go in terms of reforming ritual. And there was not always agreement. So some of the more radical reformers, as they're called, said, let's move Shabbat from Saturday to Sunday. Why? Because we live in Europe, and it's ridiculously hard to close your store on a Saturday, because you also have to close it on a Sunday because of the laws in the 19th century. You couldn't open your shop on a Sunday, which meant that you were at a competitive disadvantage of only being able to be open 5 days a week as opposed to 6 days a week. And so some radical reformers said, let's do a Sunday Shabbat. It's not ideal, but the most important thing is that we set aside 1 day a week for rest and for relaxation, being with the family and community. Let's move it to Sunday. Other people said, so that was the radical wing. Others said, you know what, let's just emphasize Friday night. Everybody can come home from work on a Friday night and then go to shul. It's still Jewish Shabbat. You don't have to move anything. You just say, instead of the priority being Saturday morning, now the priority is Friday night. And for some of those Reformed Jews, they even went so far as to introduce Torah reading on Friday night, because traditionally Torah reading is done on Saturday morning, but it's also done on Monday morning and Thursday morning. And the reason why Monday and Thursday morning and Saturday morning is because in the ancient Jewish world, that's when Jews were together anyways. They would come together on Shabbat, and then Monday and Thursdays were considered market days, when all the farmers would come in from their farm and set up shop on High Street or whatever, and have their farmer's market. So since everybody was together anyways, and not off separated, they would do a Torah reading on Monday and Thursday mornings. There is a historical reason why the practice developed the way it did. That historical reason went out 2,000 years ago. So a lot of Reformed Jews said, well, if everyone's coming together on Friday night now because they work on Saturday mornings, maybe not ideal, but that's European society, there's no choice, let's do a Torah reading on Friday night. So you had some Reform synagogues doing that. The oldest specifically Reform rabbinic seminary is the one I went to in Cincinnati, Ohio, Hebrew Union College. When they, and in the end of the 19th century, their first class of rabbis, American-trained rabbis, there were four of them, they held a banquet to celebrate. And the banquet went down in history as being known as the Trefa Banquet, because things on the menu were oysters and frog legs, and all these things that are not kosher. And it's seen by a lot of historians, and probably people at the time too, as a statement more than anything else. Look at us. We're serving frog legs. We're serving oysters, shellfish, non-kosher animals, things that the Reform movement was in the United States specifically saying, we're not bound by the laws of keeping kosher anymore. A few synagogues did try to replace the shofar with the trumpet. What this did was it created a little bit of a break within the Reform world over how far to go. So in this country, you have something called Masorti Judaism, traditional Judaism. Really what it, and that exists around the world too. Some countries it's more popular than others. But essentially what that is just a difference between Masorti and Reform over the degree of ritual change with which they're comfortable. So in principle, Masorti and Reform agree that Judaism progresses over time, that Judaism changes, that it's a product of time, and that nothing's as stagnant as some Orthodox Jews would make it seem. It's never been stagnant. So they agree with all the premises. What they disagree on was how far they were willing to go to make changes in the modern period. So that led to the break between Reform and Masorti. At one point, Reform and Masorti were together. Masorti is a traditional breakaway from Reform. But they're still not Orthodox because they agree with all the premises. Perhaps the most famous Masorti rabbi in this country was Rabbi Louis Jacobs, who's since passed away. But he wrote about a lot of these different things, these ideas about, on the one hand, maintaining Jewish practice as it's been handed down with only minor modifications as is necessary, but still seeing Judaism as progressing over time. And he's considered one of the greatest writers in the English language on Jewish thought generally. Way more people than just Masorti Jews read what Rabbi Louis Jacobs had to read. I think we had three or four books that were required reading in rabbinic school, and I didn't go to a Masorti rabbinic school. If I did, it'd be more. But you see that shift elsewhere. In the United States, that Trefa banquet where they served frog legs and oysters and whatnot, that led in part to the rise of the conservative movement, the Masorti movement in the United States. Because people got up and they walked out of the banquet. They were so offended that they would serve non-kosher meal at the ordination ceremony for rabbis They couldn't wrap their mind around it. So they went off and they started their own rabbinic school, Jewish Theological Seminary, which oddly enough was funded by Reform Jews because of immigration patterns. You start to have a lot, at that same time, you had a lot of Eastern European Jews moving to the United States, and they really didn't want German Reform, which was the style of Reform at the time, because Eastern European and German didn't mesh well together. So the Reform Jews funded the conservative Masorti movement so that Eastern European Jews could have a place to go that was not Orthodox, because it'd be too embarrassing to have these old world Eastern European Jews walking around. It would offend the sensibilities of the German Jews. So the German Jews funded the Eastern European synagogues. Those distinctions in the 21st century are more or less gone. It was just a feature of the 19th century. Yeah.
That sounds a bit delicate.
Say,
how are Reform rabbis generally accepted by Orthodox rabbis?
They're not. The question is how... The question is, how are Reform rabbis accepted by Orthodox rabbis? And for the most part, they're not. You have to understand, Orthodoxy arose in opposition to Reform. They said, absolutely not. We're not interested in how Judaism progressed over time. We're not interested in hearing that Judaism 2,000 years ago was different than Judaism 200 years ago. We're not interested that Judaism is not stagnant. To us, Judaism came from God to Moses, progressed faithfully through the thousands of years, and not a thing has changed, and we wait 6 hours between our hamburger and our cheesecake. Sorry?
They've not moved on at all.
No, and it, well, you can make the argument that they think that some of them think that they are changing, but the very premise of the word orthodoxy is correct doctrine, or correct practice, I should say. Orthopraxis, correct practice. Orthodox is correct doctrine. That by the very word orthodox, they're making a statement. And that one could argue, if you're a historian, that Judaism has never been orthodox lowercase o. That there's always been a multiplicity of beliefs and they've coexisted side by side. You could look at rabbinic writings, midrash, where one rabbi would say one thing, another rabbi completely contradicting them in terms of belief about God and so on. And they would just sit side by side and they'd be published in the same volume and everybody was okay with that because this is one person's understanding and that's another person's understanding and then they're not going to get too fussed about it. And then orthodoxy comes along and says, no, this. So by its nature, they're not going to be happy with reform. But that's their raison d'etre. More questions? Okay, let me just, I've still got a few minutes. What I want to do is talk a little bit about what World War I had to do with all this. World War II, because of the Holocaust, completely broke the model for the most part. World War I, and then after World War I, the Great Depression still had an impact. Remember, Reform Judaism is not Reformed Judaism. It's not past tense. It's not that Jews in the 19th century saw themselves as making all the necessary changes and then they too were going to freeze it out of the 19th century. They were open that Judaism would mean something different in the 20th century than it meant in the 19th century. And one of the things that happened in the early 20th century was World War I and a little bit afterwards, the Great Depression. And with World War I and the Great Depression was a shake in the confidence in progress and modernity. Too many people died. World War I, particularly in Europe, so I'll leave the United States out of it just for now, even though the United States came in at the very end of the war, but it really impacted this continent. The United Kingdom, but also Germany, was pretty much ground zero as well. So German Jewish life post-World War I. And then the Depression afterwards. All of a sudden, living in the 20th century seemed terrible. If only we could have things like our ancestors of the 19th century. All that optimism, all that wonderful whatever. And so you start to see some Reformed Jews reclaiming a little bit of what they cast off. And they said, we'll find comfort in these ritual practices. We're not going to accept them the way Orthodox did or the way we once did, but to re-examine some of the old ways of doing things and find some sort of solace and find some sort of community and find some sort of retreat away from the world, which is terrible, into something which seems a little bit more eternal and a little bit more of a sanctuary. Because what's the point of fully embracing the modern world if the modern world is war and poverty and everything else? So you really do, some of the more radical things that I read about the end of the 19th century, Shabbat on Sunday, trumpets instead of shofars, completely doing away with keeping kosher. A lot of Jews said, what's the point? Why are we giving up what we have when the alternative is just a mess of a world? World War II hadn't even happened yet, like I said. But you already start to see some of the cracks in the more radical parts of Reform Judaism. So to my knowledge, there's no place that uses a trumpet as a shofar. I don't know of any synagogue in the world that is really considering moving Shabbat to Sunday now. Friday nights are still a possibility. I grew up in a synagogue like that where Friday night was the big night. This synagogue here, Bromley, when it was first founded in the 1960s, even then, and 70s after that, even then Friday nights were still the big time because it was hard for people to come in on Saturday mornings. But what you see is a little bit less gusto in throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Whereas people were, you know, that's the critique of the 20th century, the 19th century, maybe it's a little too hard on them, but that's more or less where things moved. World War I, Great Depression. Yeah?
What are those debates within Judaism now?
What are the debates happening now?
Where are they?
Where are they? Reform Judaism is much more ritually traditional now than it was in the 19th century. There's a lot more openness and so on. And then this is around the world too. There is a little bit of a difference between liberal and reform in this country, but for the most, around issues of ritual, but for the most part, nobody's there. The big debates that were in the 20th century, a lot of those, to be honest, we've moved on from as well. So starting in the, as early as the 1960s and 1970s, some of the questions were, can the child of a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother be considered Jewish without need for conversion? And it was a path from the 1960s until now to resolve that question. I guess we're still working on that, but in the United States, both movements in this country, liberal and reform, and elsewhere, are pretty much on an equilateral place. Same-sex relationships and marriages, that was something that started, the discussions for revisiting started in the 1960s and 70s. But more or less around the world within the Reform movement, it's considered accepted that a same-sex relationship is exactly the same as between a man and a woman. So we've moved on from those. There's also a sense, I suppose, of a bit of a broad tent that we don't always have to decide everything as a movement. We can decide things as a synagogue, which also reduces the tension in the movement as a whole. Doing more local decision-making rather than movement-wide decision-making. Some of the challenges that we're moving into is that in the context of 19th century and early 20th century, there was still a sense that society as a whole was pretty religious, whereas in the 21st century, society as a whole is not pretty religious, it's pretty secular. So carving out a space for Reform Judaism in the context of a society that already sees itself as attending church and thinking of itself maybe as a more or less secular country, but still heavily involved in religious life, depending upon which country you're talking about, to a time period in the 21st century when all the shared language is more or less secular language. It's not religious language. I think the United States is probably the last Western country to make that shift. But it's obvious there that, you know, even up until recently, it was very common for presidents to be speaking in very religious language, and for pretty much politicians and social commentary in the United States, which does have a pretty strong separation of church and state, but in terms of language being used and thought, even that country is moving towards a pretty secular direction. So how does Reform Judaism thrive as a religious movement in a setting that is not really religious? So I would say that's actually probably one of the more, one of the bigger challenges that's confronting Reform Judaism now, is not so much looking over its shoulder towards orthodoxy, but looking over the other shoulder towards secular life.
Do we believe in a Messiah to come?
Do we believe in the Messiah to come? Well, I can only speak for me. What about you? You don't know. Reformed Judaism, for the most part, this was one of the biggest things, was it did stop speaking in terms of a personal Messiah who's going to come and bring salvation, which was a rabbinic notion. Some degree of biblical one, too. But they start speaking about a messianic age that we're working towards. So sort of utopian ideal. And if we're all involved in social action and social justice, then we'll bring about a time that doesn't have poverty and doesn't have war and all these other things. And we'll call that the messianic age, a time that we're always moving towards but never quite arriving at. So it's an ideal in the impossible to reach future that we should be working towards, which is very different than the notion that God's going to send the Messiah, who's going to be essentially a lion following from King. This is the Jewish understanding of Messiah, not Christian, but the Jewish understanding of Messiah, which just means anointed one, who's going to be a descendant of King David, who reclaims the throne of the kingdom of Israel and reestablishes the kingdom of Israel. That's the Jewish understanding of Messiah. Reformed Jews were not looking forward to somebody reestablishing the kingdom of Israel, nor were they looking forward to the rebuilding of the temple and having a third temple so the priests could run around slaughtering animals and barbecuing them and whatever. So all those things that went along with the messianic, with a personal Messiah, no. Zionism as well affected messianic thought. To this day, a lot of prayer books, Reform and Orthodox, refer to Israel as the beginning of the flowering of the messianic period, or the beginning of the flowering of redemption, or using all this messianic language to go along with the state of Israel. But that just might be poetry rather than literal belief. Depends on who you ask. Okay. Any other questions?
Do we believe in life after death?
Do we believe, again, I can't speak for you. Do we believe in life after death? In Reformed Judaism, but this is true of Judaism more generally, there's no certainties that come with it. There's not expected to be a belief in the certainty of what happens to us after we die. Various Jewish thinkers, this predates Reform Judaism, have talked about everything from resurrection to reincarnation to heaven and hell, you name it. And obviously all those can't go together. You can't both go to hell or heaven and be resurrected at the same time or be reincarnated. If there's reincarnation, then which body is going to get resurrected? Are you going to split a soul into different pieces? But different Jewish authors have indulged. But the important thing to note is that that's never been the focus of Judaism, is life after death. The focus of Judaism has always been, how do we live life in this world right here, rather than be preoccupied with a world that we can't know anything about. Judaism has never seen really the purpose of focusing on something that's just not real for them right now. It might be real, but it's not real for them in the moment, so they can't do anything about it. So what's the point? And can't know anything about it. Nobody, no reliable source has ever come back, reliable from a Jewish point of view, has ever come back and given a good report on life after death. So no ghosts or whatever to say, you know what, here we go. This is a report from the afterlife.
Maybe it's just so good
that
they don't want us all to go.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, maybe. Wouldn't that be nice? So lots of Jews have believed different things. Everyone's empowered by Jewish tradition to believe pretty much whatever they want in terms of heaven, hell, and whatnot. And there are people with strong beliefs in the synagogue and elsewhere. Good. We will meet next week. We'll be talking about modern Reform Judaism. And what I mean by, it's all modern, I should say contemporary Reform Judaism. And what I mean by that is post-World War II, post-Holocaust, post-founding of the State of Israel, up until now. What is Reform Judaism right now, 2017, United Kingdom and around the world? Okay? And how those influences of the latter part of the 20th century influenced us to get to where we are now. Good questions. Nice seeing everybody. See you next week. Bye.